This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Stephen Esposito, the president of Yellowstone Wealth Management in Lake Forest. By the way, Stephen, our Steve Alexander mentioned yesterday that $14.2 billion was spent over a two-day period thanks to that Amazon sale. That's a big number, isn't it?
Hi, how are you? Yes, that's a big number. Probably not for Amazon, but for anybody else, right?
Yeah, no kidding. But maybe it does say something about the consumer's willingness to spend. I also saw that 69 stocks in the S&P 500 have reached new 52-week highs. That's good for the market, right?
Well, the more broadening you get, that's not, as a percentage, it's pretty small, but you're starting to see a lot of the rest of the market come and participate. We've talked about that repeatedly. I think that's very healthy, and it's starting to happen as we speak because the confidence on interest rates, the economy, better than expected retail sales, not just this last month, but they revised upward the prior 2 months. The confidence is returning and some visibility going forward. So I think that's why you're seeing this.
Is that called rotation? Is that what rotation is?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when you have seven stocks out of 500, 35% of the market, that's just not healthy. And when you look at the S&P, it's really not the market like you would traditionally think. So the fact that you're getting some catch up and some leveling off, I think is good. I really do. I've been waiting for this and hoping for it, and we're positioned for it. And I'm just hoping it continues. And I think it will as we get through the rest of the year, as interest rates signal they're coming down. I think you'll see continued increase in the broad market, financials, et cetera, as we go.
Financials, et cetera. Yeah, what's that, et cetera? What kind of companies are going to prosper the most then going forward?
Well, as we thought, some of the consumer cyclicals, which has just been beaten up and haven't followed, you're looking, many of the auto companies are hitting new 52-week highs in some cases. Healthcare is actually getting a bid the last few days. I think that's cheap. Again, I'm a big fan of the banks and the regionals. We have been. We've been, you know, we've owned them for a while now, and they're really starting to perform. Doing much better. So anything in the other, everyone was almost everything but the Max 7. I think the retail sales shows the consumer is still very strong, much better than most people thought. And I think there's plays in there. These stocks are so cheap on valuation basis that they could go up a lot and still be pretty cheap. So we'll see if this continues. I think it will.
You're not down on AI or, say, microchips, are you?
No. We have technology in our portfolios, and we've participated. We just don't have that weighting that it's most of our portfolios. We're more of a balanced manager, I think. We're not looking to hit the ball out of the park. Sometimes they'll go over the fence, but no. I mean, we do have many of the tech names. They're just not as heavily weighted as other people. Some of them are coming down. I might buy some of them. The way they're getting hit, I'm actually looking at adding to those positions.
Like an NVIDIA?
I can't give you specific names, but we're scanning the horizon for a technical support, among other things, and we'll see.
I've got my finger. I can go to a chart and find the seven and see which has gone down the most and then say, yeah, I know those are maybe not doing real well this week or this month, but I'll bet on them for the next year. This would be a good time to just pull the trigger on something like that.
Well, it could be. I don't know yet. We're going to see how this thing trades going forward. I try to buy. I don't want to buy some of these 60 and 80 multiple stocks. I can't do it. It goes against my grain.
Yeah.
But some of these other ones are still cheap, and I've got to like them better than some of the other cyclicals I like, or some of the other healthcare stocks I like. I'm more concerned with the downside. In terms, you don't want to lose 50% because then you've got to make 100 to get even. I'd rather miss one and then find another one. At that point, but I've got to be comfortable before I put in a portfolio. It's got to be what I feel is cheap.
One last thing. If the Fed cuts rates twice this year, does that change your outlook in any way?
No, it enforces it. They would enforce it. And the talk is next year on the street, there maybe 100, 200 more basis points. So I'm looking out not to the end of the year. I'm looking out to next year.
Okay.
When we put on positions.
Well, I appreciate that, but you'll understand that so many people miss the mark by so much on Fed cuts this year that somebody who wants to tell me there'll be 4-quarter-point rate cuts next year must have a book I don't have.
Same book I don't have either. but I do think if inflation continues in this pace, the Fed can't. The inverted yield curve, the amount of time the yield curve has been inverted is the longest time in history. So you've way past their welcome there, and you're not that far from going to a normal yield curve. So if the Fed is artificially keeping rates on the short end low and the longer end is really the market, that as this continues to go and the Fed starts cutting rates, that could have a dramatic effect on the economy, dramatic effect in financials, real estate. Some of those concerns about refining some of these commercial properties could get better. It could have a really profound effect as you head into 2025. And that's what I think is going to happen. How much, I don't know. I mean, nobody knows. But if they do cut maybe another 100 basis points next year or 50, that's still good. It's better than where we're at now.
Stephen Esposito is president of Yellowstone Wealth Management. They are in Lake Forest. YellowstoneWM.com. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Bree Fowler is here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, senior reporter at CNET, to tell us that, among other things, Elon Musk says he's moving the SpaceX headquarters. Why is he doing that, Bree?
Well, I mean, he says this has to do with some California policies, but, you know, he's moved a number of his companies to Texas in the last couple of years. So SpaceX is just kind of following the trend for him.
From California to Texas, SpaceX.
Yes. Oh. Yep, and along with X, the former Twitter.
Oh, is that also in Texas now?
Yep, they're both moving there. Twitter will be moving from San Francisco to Texas, and SpaceX also will move its corporate headquarters there.
And is it just for tax purposes, or is there, you know, maybe the employees and the technology is there? I wonder why he's doing that.
Well, there's definitely a tax benefit to doing this. Texas has no state personal income tax. Musk has also moved his residency to Texas from California. So you figure that that's going to be a bit cheaper for him. You know, Elon Musk is saying that it has to do with a new law that Governor Gavin Newsom in California recently signed that deals with schools and banning them from requiring staff to notify parents of a child's gender identification change. So there's some social politics here, too. Elon Musk has been very vocal during the Republican convention about his support for Donald Trump. So that factors in there, too.
You've got a story about cybersecurity, too. Who's Kaspersky and what is this all about?
Well, Kaspersky is a very long-running cybersecurity company. It is based in Moscow. And it's been around for a long time. They made consumer antivirus that was sold all over the world and also enterprise versions. And they have some of the best researchers in cybersecurity. You know, they do a lot when it comes to finding and exposing elite hacking groups, things like that. But the problem is, you know, the U.S. government has a problem with Russian companies having that kind of access. This kind of ties in with the whole China and TikTok thing. Kaspersky was deemed to be a threat, potentially, to U.S. security. And the U.S. government has banned the use of the company's software here.
Oh, no kidding. Well, that does, that's fascinating to me that of all places from Russia, there would be somebody doing cybersecurity, since a lot of us wonder if some of the hacks that we get don't originate from Russia.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of what made them on the upside a very good cybersecurity company. Many ransomware and cybercrime groups are based in Russia or in the former Soviet republics, countries that don't extradite to the United States. But Kaspersky's researchers, I mean, a lot of them are Russian-speaking, have a good knowledge of that kind of software. And, you know, Russia has a lot of businesses, too, that need to be protected. Yeah. So it was kind of a global company that happened to be based in Russia. I mean, that's not to say that, you know, people in the security industry didn't make jokes and comments about, you know, the company being Russian-owned and based for years. But this is all kind of coming to a head now, and they are pulling up stakes and leaving America.
They are leaving America because the Commerce Department has banned their use. Well, do I know them? I mean, like I've seen Norton antivirus software. Is Kaspersky a name that I recognize as a consumer?
Definitely. When I worked at Consumer Reports, it was one of the softwares that we tested and rated. It's very well known, and it was considered a quality product. I mean, it's one of those boxes that you would see, you know, right. back when people bought any virus in a box. But they've definitely fallen out of favor. The move is only supposed to eliminate about 50 jobs. I kind of wonder if they're people I know too, because I know I know some great researchers that work there that are based in California.
One last thing. Talk to me about robot umpires. What's going to happen here?
Yeah, this could be really interesting. Rob Manfred, the head of MLB, is saying that they may be testing these out in spring training coming up next year. The idea would that these robot umpires, which would be purely used to call balls and strikes and mainly in challenge kinds of situations, would be tested out in spring training and then be used potentially, if they do well, in the 2026 MLB season. Right now, they're being used in AAA baseball. And they're technically very accurate, but there are still some bugs they need to hammer out as far as the strike zone and things like that.
Well, is the idea that there'll be an umpire calling it, and if the batter wants to challenge the call, or maybe the pitcher does, then they'll review the tape the way they do, say, in tennis?
Yeah, and it kind of is like a video review, just kind of at a higher level. That the technology would be able to tell if the ball is within the strike zone. Because it's very technical. It would look solely at where the ball is when it crosses the midpoint of the plate, which is about 8.5 inches from the front and back of it. And, you know, they still are trying to define the strike zone. They recently made it bigger. So this is, you know, just kind of little technical things that need to be figured out before they can roll this out on a big scale.
Well, I don't have time to work on this much right now, but it just seems to me like you could call the, it just seems to me like you could tell if it was inside or outside, but the height of the batters varies depending on who's up to bat. So the
right.
strike zone gets taller. So somebody's got to push a button to generate the strike zone for individual hitters. And that's subjective. I think the computer isn't going to be perfect that way.
And this is one of the things that they have said that they need to figure out, because it does vary. And the strike zone, they recently expanded it. It's a larger percentage. It's more than 50% of a player's total height now. So they need to factor that in and figure that out. But,
wow.
I mean, it's working well enough in AAA baseball that they're still using it.
Bree Fowler is a senior reporter at CNET.com. Always nice to talk to you. Thank you, Bree.
Thanks for having me.
You hear those commercials for Jeff Buys Your House. There really is a guy named Jeff, Jeff Neidiger. He is the co-founder and innovator of this business, and he joins us now to help us understand exactly how they do what they do. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
So you buy houses, and as we've said on the radio, I don't have to worry about cleaning it out. I don't have to worry about anything. Within 24 hours, you give me an offer, and there's no commissions, as I recall. Talk to us just a little bit about your business model. How does that work?
Yeah, so we started in 2007, and we've been buying houses, well, all over the Chicagoland metro area. But yeah, it's pretty simple. We don't serve everyone in the market. A lot of folks that want to sell their house, it might be a good decision for them to go more of the retail route and call up their local broker or friend or whatever. But for the ones that are looking for something that's a little more easy and hassle-free, and as you said, as is, we make it, well, it's simple and hassle-free. It's an as is all cash offer. And when they contact us, we have a conversation, come out and meet with them at their home, and walk them through the process, and hopefully are able to provide them with that cash offer and close the deal on their time frame, which is kind of one of the sticking points that we've got here. Is it's not necessarily up to us. It's we want to work with them on their time frame that works best for them. And quite honestly, we've got closings that are all the way out in October and early November right now already.
Oh, that's interesting. So sometimes the people are not in as big a rush as you might be. You could give them the cash, but they say, but I'm not ready yet. We're still handling our affairs, huh?
Yeah, I would say the majority of folks that want to work with us, might think they need a quick closing, and some do. But oftentimes we're seeing more and more as time's gone on. At least this year, you know, like I said, folks want to reach out and hey, could you close on a certain date?
Right.
And some people are trying to line up a closing date with a purchase date, so they're selling the house to us.
Yeah.
And they want to use those funds for a future purchase, maybe it's out of state or down the road, or doesn't matter to us, but we can certainly accommodate.
Describe for me the typical scenario, either the circumstances under which somebody asks you to just take the property and give them cash, or either the circumstances or who those people are. What is the typical transaction for you?
Sure. It's kind of, it's not really a one size fits all, I'm sure, as you can imagine, but it's not like usually a dire straits 2008-2009 scenario where there's no equity and it's a foreclosure or pending foreclosure. We don't see much of that, of course. I'm sure as you're aware, in the last 10 years, most people have built up quite a bit of equity.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times, honestly, it's really they're making a financial decision to go this path and to sell to us for cash. But they do want the as is. Of course, they're drawn in by that, and we do mean what we say by that, and selling it in the current condition. We're covering all the closing costs, which are important to them. So when we give you an offer, you're getting really close to what would be more of a net purchase price to them. There's not a lot of math involved that they've got to do to say, what is the bottom line? It's, you know, besides them paying the real estate taxes, and maybe they have an HOA they've got to pay off, everything else is really theirs. Again, they get that closing date. And the other thing is, a lot of these folks, maybe it's a sibling or a family member of a loved one that's just recently passed, and they've been given the house, or a lot of times working with siblings, and that kind of gets messy and complicated. You've got multiple people involved, and they want to sell mom and dad's house. Everybody kind of wants their way of doing it. And so we're really good at working in the family situations. We're a family-owned business, so we get working through that dynamic. Where they get to go in the house, get what they want or what was given to them, and then we take everything else. As you can imagine, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years of stuff accumulates, and it's like, now what do we do? We use some discretion there and again, accommodate them on what they need, and we'll take the rest, and then we work towards closing together.
Yeah, I have imagined that it would typically be that kind of a case. Mom and dad have passed. Now we have this home. Maybe it's downstate. Maybe I'm downstate. But, you know, we're not interested in painting it and fixing it up and then marketing it and doing all of that. Let's just be real clean about it. Sell the house, see what you can get. But then what do you do with everything that's inside? Do you buy, sell, or throw away? Is that kind of – there's other companies that will do that. They'll tell you what to donate, what to sell, and what to pitch. How do you make those calls?
Yeah, the honest answer is we try and be very clear with them up front so that we make sure that they've got all the stuff that they want. And honestly, sometimes a day after closing or 2 days or even a week, they may call up and say, hey, did you ever run into – dad's old fill in the blank or mom's old fill in the blank. And again, if we see something of value or we think might be of value, we try and be sensitive there and then put that aside.
Yeah.
But yes, to answer your question, between some junk out companies that are pretty sensitive with the stuff, they know about how to handle the stuff that needs to be recycled or can be recycled. We do partner with a few different companies that go through and can use some of that stuff as thrift. And for those that are in need, we'd certainly hate to, you know, just fill up a landfill all with old furniture and goods because, again, as it's been taught, right, that someone else's trash is another person's treasure. It's true, but they don't all go like that. Sometimes it's just neglect, and it really is a lot of stuff inside your garage or your basement that needs to be just drug out and thrown in the dumpster, and it's a lot of work.
It's funny because you are relatively young. I have your bio in front of me. You deployed on multiple combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan in the early 2000s. You've got four kids, but you're this young businessman who's a veteran. Now you're no longer in the service. What dropped you into this, and where do you get the cash to finance all of the homes that you have to pay cash for?
Yeah, great questions. Well, first and foremost, I guess the veteran-owned component is near and dear, obviously, to my heart and to our company and those that align with us. It was obviously one of my, it was the greatest honor to me to serve our country. Even as divided as we are today, it still means a lot to us for our family to step up and to be able to do that. So I appreciate to all the veterans that do and have. So yes, I did that, and I made a transition from full-time active duty military service in the U.S. Army. And then 2007, I transitioned to a brief stint at a full-time job, and really, I really wanted to start a real estate company. Didn't know what that meant. And there's a long story there of a couple thousand houses, but have learned along the way, and then really have graduated, I guess, to really having this be a relationship business where we get to work with a lot of folks in different situations. Some are easier than others, of course, but it gets us all over town, all the way from the north side to the south side, out to DeKalb, but mostly in the Chicago suburbs. And so that's that part of it. And then, the cash part of it, well, it's a long story too, but we were able to, buy a couple dozen houses a month, even as many as 25 or 30 houses a month. And it's a business for us that we're able to buy, again, off market directly from the seller, where there's no other parties involved, and it's very clean that way. And then, we become a reseller. A lot of times we're adding value to these properties, bringing them back up in the neighborhood, which ends up making the neighbors happy, of course, that the house that might have been neglected or needed some love, and we can go ahead and do that and then go back to the market for a new family.
Yeah, but then where is Jeff sells your house? If Jeff buys all these houses, I want to buy one of those houses. There might still be some discount left for me. Do you promote the marketing of those homes then?
Yes, we do. We've got a small private network that we do that on, and then the majority of those are going to go to the multiple listing service through a real estate broker, and then they'll be available to you, me, or anybody else that might be looking for.
What's the average cost or value? How much you typically, is it 300? I bet it's not 500,000. I bet it's 300,000 or less would be the homes you're normally dealing in.
Yeah, the average purchase price is just under about $300,000. And then, we're going to be anywhere from, let's say, $320,000, $350,000, $400,000. We kind of play in anymore what is a middle market, and that just kind of shakes out that way from different various types of advertising on TV or radio. But that ends up being your kind of Midwest suburban house. You're right about the $500,000 house. That was the $300,000 house, 6 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago. But a lot of these ones that are and they're not all in disrepair. We just bought a brand new construction house. That about a month ago, and that was probably our first one. It was actually completed this year, and this gentleman bought it, and about a week later was received a new position in Texas, and so he contacted us. He wanted exactly what I already talked about, an as is, which didn't, he wanted something that was really easy, and the closing date was more important to him to line up those dates, and we gave him that, and so he lived in his new house for about a month and a half.
Jeff Neidiger is the co-founder and innovator, can you tell, of Jeff Buys Your House. That's the website, jeffbuysyourhouse.com. It's jeffbuysyourhouse.com, not Jeff Neidiger buysyourhouse.com, because nobody would know how to spell that. But jeffbuysyourhouse.com, we can do. Hey, Jeff, congratulations. Our best to you in the market, and thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Interesting story. More business news now. Here is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Gas prices could spike in the Chicago area after a power outage impacted the ExxonMobil refinery near Joliet. Damaged transmission towers have been fixed, but it's unclear whether power's been fully restored to the facility. It lost service for several days. Gasoline futures for the Chicago area shot up nearly 15 cents, and GasBuddy.com says prices at the pump could jump 20 to 40 cents in the Great Lakes region as a result. There are three refineries in the Chicago area. When one of them goes down, analysts say there's little to no cushion of extra supply in the area. United Airlines says its third quarter profit will fall short of Wall Street expectations. Chicago-based carrier says price cuts by budget carriers will weigh on the entire industry. The discount airlines added seats earlier this year, and they're now trying to fill those seats by dropping fares. Bigger rivals like United have had to match some of the price cuts to remain competitive. United says third quarter earnings will likely come in at $2.75 to $3.25 per share. Wall Street had been expecting $3.38 a share. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, and listen to this. Sounds like our old pal, Max Armstrong, is in a bit of trouble.
The voicemail message said, Mr. Armstrong, would you please give me a call? This is Agent Wormer with the FBI.
Oh, Max, what have you done now? Stand by and we'll find out after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, WGN legend Max Armstrong gets a phone call from the FBI. It wasn't something he did, though. It was his elderly father living alone on a farm in southwest Indiana, scammed by telemarketers.
They had worked Dad by way of telephone for quite some time and convinced him that if he sent a few $1,000s, he would then be a finalist for a lottery, and they convinced him he really had a good chance of winning all that money.
Do you know how much he lost?
By our calculation, Dad lost maybe $30,000 altogether.
Wow. And the scammers don't care whether you live in the city or in the country on a farm or ranch, which is why the USDA is putting out this advice.
Don't answer calls from unfamiliar numbers.
And extension educator Barbara Stockbrand says you need to be careful of even numbers you know, because the scammers have technology that will make it appear that the call is coming from someone you may trust or even know.
They're rerouted so that they look like a local number. Scammers know that their targets are more likely to answer those.
And if you do answer and the person sounds so nice,
they say whatever they can to gain your trust.
And if they tell you, they'll take you off the list for future calls.
By taking the steps to opt out, you're confirming that there's someone on the other side of that phone that they have called. And that is something they're hoping for, so that they can sell your number to other telemarketers.
Yeah, clever people with endless ways to scam you.
Someone calling from Social Security needing your personal information, or the IRS with threats of arrest.
And it goes on and on, whatever they can think of to separate you from your money. So the best advice, don't answer the call. And if you do answer, and it isn't who you think it is, hang up. On the food calendar, today's National Caviar Day. It's National Tropical Fruit Day and National Sour Candy Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Dale Buss from the Flyover Coalition, the contributing editor of Chief Executive Magazine, was in Chicago just the other day at McCormick Place for the Institute of Food Technologists' first convention. I understand you moderated a panel over there, Dale. I'm sorry I missed you, but what did you all talk about?
Well, yeah, John, I'm also a contributing editor to Food Technology Magazine, which is published by the IFT. And so this is one of Chicago's biggest food industry shows of every year, obviously. And so the floor was packed with people selling better-for-you ingredients, plant-based stuff, you name it. But there's a lot of concern in the food business about the business of food these days. And so the panel I hosted was about inflation and the lasting effects of inflation. And what's going on is really as fresh as today's headlines. The CEO of ConAgra the other day said they've had disappointing sales in their frozen and refrigerated foods, really contributing to a hard stretch for the company. And PepsiCo's CEO said they're actually going to cut the prices of some Frito-Lay snacks because consumers are resisting. So this is a big, big deal. And it's interesting because all the reports lately have been that inflation is actually moderating. But what consumers are responding to, and what we talked about at the Institute of Food Technology session, is that they're still responding to the huge price hikes that the grocery industry had in 2022 and 2023. So the perception by consumers is food prices are out of control, restaurant prices are out of control, labor costs and tips contribute to that. So it's actually, as you know, well know, it's a political issue too. It's a kitchen table issue this year.
So do they propose a solution to that? I guess, you know, dropping prices is one thing. Some of us note that what they're doing, if they're dropping prices, is also making the quantities smaller. But how are they responding to this?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the food industry is responding in a number of ways. That's one way, which is lower the price or keep it even, but make the portion sizes smaller, right? So that's more profitable for them, you know, an entry point for consumers that they can still handle, but obviously smaller sizes. More consumers are going to private label stuff. So you've got Walmart and Target introducing vast new lines of product label private label, you know, store brand merchandise. Promotions are much bigger now than they were, you know, 1, 2, 3 years ago. All the brands are saying we've got to tell consumers on the basis of price point, you know, what we've got for them, that they can get into this product that they're used to buying at a certain point, and we've got to cut the price at least temporarily. And they're doing more digital and brand loyalty promotions to try to get that stickiness with consumers, you know, that relationship cuts through price resistance.
But Costco and Walmart are very profitable companies, and we buy a lot of our food from them. I know the margins are slim on groceries, but are these companies doing okay?
Yeah. I mean, the retailers are still, by and large, doing okay because they're simply, you know, passing along price increases, and consumers are only starting to resist. So you've got some volume resistance by consumers. They're not buying as much, but the companies are maintaining their profits. But, you know, as we have these macro factors like a bit of an economic slowdown, we've got the political mess going on, all these things kind of contribute to a consumer who's just not quite comfortable these days. A lot of financial pressures. And so they feel that more often at the gas pump and at the food checkout line. And that's where the anxiety comes from. And the industry's, you know, trying to cope with that.
Emblematic of that, you wrote in your story early on, was the $1.50 hot dog and soda that you can get at Costco. And people lost their minds when they said that you have to be a member in order to get the $1.50 weenie and pop. What's the status of that now?
Well, that was such a big deal earlier this year that the CFO of Costco, when he was talking to investors a few weeks ago, like one of the first things he said is the $1.50 hot dog and pop is secure. Don't worry about it, because it's a huge loss leader for them. And, you know, that's kind of a sign of the times that people are concerned. Like, there's one deal they knew they could get when they went to Costco, whether they were necessarily a member or not. You know, they have them out in the parking lots at some Costcos, and it's secure. We know where we can go for a good deal on a hot dog.
You can read more about this at, well, should I send them to ift.org? You've got a lot of
ift.org. Yeah, Food Technology Magazine there.
Yeah, Dale Buss is a contributing editor of Chief Executive Magazine, obviously involved in that. You can also find his stuff at flyovercoalition.org. Dale, we'll visit another day. Thank you.
Thanks, John.